Good morning. As our minister Marcia says, it's good to see you, and it's good to be seen. Today, I will talk on the subject of education. Here's a standard dictionary definition of educate. Quote, to give intellectual, moral, and social instruction to someone, especially a child, typically at a school or university. It's from the Latin word educat, meaning to lead forth. However, it's just a little more complicated than that. In this talk, I draw heavily on the first two of the UU's seven sources, my own direct experiences as a student, worker, parent, and a teacher, the words and deeds reflecting the experience of others, quoting from the writers who've had the deepest influence on my thinking about education. About my experience. I attended public school through high school, K-1 in a large urban school in Seattle, moving to a rural three-room school outside Corvallis for grades 2 to 6, then into town for 7 through 9 at junior high, and finally 10 to 12 at high school in Corvallis. I was going to be a professor like my dad, or a rocket scientist, helping us go to the moon, or maybe Mars. 4 years at Reed College and a bachelor's degree in physics, all set for graduate school and a PhD, but the Vietnam War and the draft got in the way, so in 1968 I fell off that life track, but that's another story. I worked for 2 years as a conscientious objector, as a house parent at the Perry Center Group Home for, quote, emotionally disturbed children here in Portland. There, I realized that the children were not intrinsically or genetically ill, but rather had become that way in response to highly dysfunctional families. They had become output challenged, unable to produce all the requested behaviors of their environments. In fact, the 5 or 6 children I lived with were complex, capable, interesting people, and I came to admire them in their struggle to grow up and fit in. Then my first real job, several years as a welfare caseworker in North and Northeast Portland, with a telephone, file drawer, pens, and a bewildering variety of forms, I managed the financial lives of 200 to 250 welfare families. They lived in North Portland, including the largest public housing project in Portland, Columbia Villa. Besides keeping track of who was living there, I had to keep track of their income from child support or work, help them get connected with food stamps, housing assistance, WIC assistance, counsel them in budgeting, and visit them in their homes several times a year. The conditions of the families, especially the children, was startling and shocking to me. From the nearly all middle-class town of Corvallis, I had never seen this, barely enough money to scrape by. All their family and friend resources, safety nets, exhausted, no work or minimum wage work, no child care, no books, no desk or light or quiet space for kids to study, worn and tattered furniture, mattresses, clothing, kitchens, cheap, low-quality food, noisy apartments, dirty yards. Meanwhile, I became part of a family, son Andrew and daughter Amanda, attending public school in Southeast Portland. As the stay-at-home dad for their preschool and elementary years, I volunteered at their schools for 10 years, first as a co-op preschool teacher, then classroom helper, after-school computer teacher, newsletter editor, advisory committee member and chair, and many other activities. I also taught TAG computer classes for Portland Public Schools. As they finished elementary school, I was divorced, however, and then remarried, and then had another child, son Nathan, now in Portland Public Schools. During this time, I became a strong proponent of the public school system, proud that Portland managed to keep most of its families in public school, something like 85% to 90%, very high for a city of our size. Mixing of ethnic groups and social classes also seemed very important, though at the time I was rather naive about the differences among schools. However, middle school and high school were not particularly positive experiences for any of our kids, and I became less enthusiastic about public school. 20 years later, working for a large software company, documenting accounting software for the nth time, I was looking for work more interesting, hopefully more meaningful and fulfilling as well. My wife Diane had been an elementary school teacher for years, and her work inspired me. After 2 years of taking part-time prerequisites, I joined a full-time cohort at PSU in the spring of 2000. Some great PSU classes, especially children's literature, linguistics, and classroom management, inspired me. My PSU professor, Ken Peterson, described a good classroom as a place where you like to be, where the students like to be, well-managed and busy. His mantra was the three C's. Curriculum, well-crafted lessons that work for all the wide range of students. Conventional control, gestures, attention signals, body language, movement. And third, certainty, being sure of yourself, trusting yourself, confident that you know what you are doing, not hesitating, conveying clearly what you expect, yet at the same time able to stop and listen, redirect or reset lessons that aren't working out, extending lessons that are going too well to interrupt. Student teaching in fourth grade at Rose City Park in Northeast Portland. At our first meeting, the principal, Dana Jacobs, told me, quote, "At our school, we don't send kids to the office to get fixed." My teaching mentor, Laura Bilderback, was about my age. She had decades of teaching experience. She was still happy, relaxed, and polite, but firm in the classroom. She urged me to study every child, to find something tangible to like and appreciate. During the first week of school, she had me write and send positive postcards to every family. Sometimes we'd stand together watching the kids working and share a chuckle as some kids did something kind of harmlessly silly. The kids would look at us curiously. What are they up to? Later, Laura told me it was important for the kids to see teachers laugh. She also cautioned me to always think about what was best for the child, what would foster their motivation to be in school and participate. This came into play while writing report cards and preparing for conferences, taking into account parental reactions, being careful not to set kids up for punishment at home. As the author Frank McCourt wrote in his book Teacher Man, quote, "I had to be careful if the dad was sitting there. If I made negative comments about Harry, the dad might go home and punch him out, and words would get out to my other students that I was not to be trusted. I was learning that teachers and kids have to stick together in the face of parents, supervisors, and the world in general." After graduating from PSU in 2001, I couldn't find a position, so I substituted for 2 years, approximately 275 days, 80 different classrooms, 35 different schools, 7 different districts. I was shocked to see the vast differences among the schools and the children. High poverty school lunch rates, at some up to 90%, low poverty as low as 10%. At the high poverty schools, the kids were more often sleepy or distracted, less able to listen to instructions or cooperate. The high poverty schools were run much more harshly and rigidly, focused sharply on scripted lessons and preparing for tests, with fewer extras like art and music and PE. I saw much evidence of exhausted and discouraged teachers in the classrooms where I substituted. However, many of those days were at the school where I had done my student teaching, Rose City Park, a solidly middle-class school with about 35 to 40% poverty. By the end of 2 years of substituting, I'd been in every room in that building. After hundreds of applications and half a dozen interviews, I was finally hired as a fourth grade teacher there at Rose City Park, the exact grade level and room where I'd done my student teaching. 4 years later, Rose City Park was moved and transformed into a K-8 school at nearby Roseway Heights. 2 more years with fourth grade, then 3 final years at fifth grade, retiring in 2012. Since then, I've been a substitute several days per month. Over 250 students were in my fourth and fifth grade classes during my 9 years. Over 2,000 students were in classes that I substituted in. During this time, I also had half a dozen student teachers looking to me as their mentor and dozens of parent helpers. As it turned out, there was a lot more to teaching than just focusing on the kids. Focusing on myself was even more important. When talking with new student teachers, I counseled them that the hardest task as a teacher, and the most important, is to manage one's emotions in the classroom. Arrive on an upbeat, steady mood, and maintain a positive reserve of energy throughout the day, prepared and able to deal with whatever comes up, no matter what. You are the show, and the show must go on. I learned that I had several audiences that I had to satisfy. In order of priority, they were, first, the kids. I had to live with them 5 or 6 hours per day, 5 days per week. They vastly outnumbered me. Besides, they were sensitive and kind and funny and hardworking if you treat them well, give them sensible tasks with enough time and help to do a good job, and don't manipulate them with behavior modification schemes. Carefully managed weekly class meetings helped students build empathy for each other, improve cooperation, and reduce conflicts. The second audience or group is their parents. This is tricky, especially if you think that the kids have a dysfunctional family, which is messing up your student. What worked for me was to reserve judgment about kids, not to go by what was, quote, on their record, but to give each kid a fresh start to show who they were in the classroom, then to really get to know and find genuine things to be interested in about every kid. If parents know you care enough to know about their kid, they will be on your side. I loved talking to parents at conferences because no one else knew the kids as well, and we could learn from each other. Fellow teachers are the third group, especially at my grade level. My fellow teachers appreciated me because I shared lessons, helped them with computer problems, and didn't gossip. Finally, my principal. I was lucky there. My principals often let me stray from the prescribed curriculum. My kids weren't in trouble, going to the office to get fixed. Parents always knew what was going on and what was expected of their kids, weren't complaining to the principal about unclear assignments or due dates or bullying or unfair treatment of their kid, and the other teachers thought well of me. What was it really like in the classroom? I often use the metaphor of driving on the freeway, having to be on every second of the day. One of the best descriptions I've found is in Frank McCourt's book, Teacher Man. He's talking about teaching high school, but what he says was true in my classrooms as well. I admit, I didn't always love teaching, he said. I was out of my depth. You're on your own in the classroom. One man or woman facing 5 classes a day, 5 classes of teenagers, 1 unit of energy against 175 units of energy, 175 ticking bombs, and you have to find ways of saving your own life. They may like you. They may even love you, but they are young, and it is the business of the young to push the old off the planet. I know I'm exaggerating, but it's like a boxer going into the ring, or a bullfighter into the arena. You can be knocked out or gored, and that's the end of your teaching career. But if you hang on, you learn the tricks. It's hard, but you have to make yourself comfortable in the classroom. You have to be selfish. The airlines tell you if oxygen fails, you are to put on your mask first, even if your instinct is to save the child. The classroom is a place of high drama. You'll never know what you've done to, or for, the hundreds coming and going. You see them leaving the classroom, dreamy, flat, sneering, admiring, smiling, puzzled. After a few years, you develop antennae. You can tell when you've reached them or alienated them. It's chemistry. It's psychology. It's animal instinct. You are with the kids, and as long as you want to be a teacher, there's no escape. McCourt again from Teacher Man. If you bark or snap, you lose them. That's what they get from parents and the schools in general, the bark and the snap. If they strike back with the silent treatment, you're finished in the classroom. Their faces change and they have a way of deadening their eyes. Tell them to open their notebooks. They stare. They take their time. Yeah, they'll open their notebooks. Yes, sir, here we go, opening our notebooks nice and easy so nothing falls out. You're just another teacher, man, so what are you going to do? Stare down the whole class? Fail the whole class? Get with it, baby. They have you by the XXX, and you created the situation, man. You didn't have to talk to them like that. They don't care about your mood, your headache, your troubles. They have their own problems, and right now you are one of them. Watch your step, teacher. Don't make yourself a problem. They'll cut you down. On a more philosophical level, what are we to believe about children? Are humans intrinsically good, or do they come with badness, born with original sin? Christianity is deeply imbued with the idea of original sin. even though we supposedly have a separation of church and state and public schools are required to be secular, Christian beliefs underlie many of our practices, including how we treat children. In this view, children are born sinful and somehow must be fixed, saved, cured of their sinfulness. Leaving this work up to the churches hasn't been sufficient, so much of that task has been put onto the school system. The Tibetan Chogyam Trungpa, in his book Shambhala, argues that we are born with, quote, basic goodness, rather than original sin. He says, when we speak of basic goodness, we are not talking about having allegiance to good and rejecting bad. Basic goodness is good because it is unconditional or fundamental. It is there already, in the same way that the sky and the earth are there already. Do we parents and adults charged with teaching look at our children as broken and sinful? Look at them with suspicion and distrust? See them as naturally lazy and rude? See them as wild creatures to be trained as if they were pets? Is there more to education than mere training through behaviorist manipulation, constantly aware of manipulating contingent rewards and punishments to shape them as if they were dogs or horses? We often look at children as beings who are being educated by us. What's really going on is they're educating themselves, making sense of their environment and stimuli as they are experiencing them, whether we like it or not. It's impossible that they could rote memorize everything we throw at them. They notice, interpret, sort, absorb, store at their own pace. We have control over much of the classroom environment, but without observing and interacting with the class constantly, we cannot provide them with the best conditions for learning. The psychologist Alfie Kohn, author of the book Punished by Rewards and many others, had a tremendous influence on my thinking in the classroom. His ideas also helped me make more sense out of my own childhood and illuminated some major missteps I'd made as a parent. Alfie Kohn, in his essay, quote, On Bribing Students to Learn, Second Thoughts About A's, Praise, Stickers, and Contests, wrote, quote, Teachers are often encouraged to rely on rewards rather than punishments, but research suggests that carrots can be just as counterproductive as sticks. Both are forms of manipulation, and neither can produce anything beyond temporary compliance. In fact, students who see themselves as doing an assignment in order to receive a gold star, an A, or an award, are actually less likely to develop an interest in the subject matter, or to challenge themselves to do their best. By the same token, stickers, popcorn parties, and even praise given to students give students no reason to act responsibly when there is no longer a goodie to be gained for doing so. For students to become lifelong learners and good people, we need to work with them, rather than using techniques like rewards and punishments, which merely do things to them. Kohn's work is echoed by Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman in their book Nurture Shock, where they argue that praising kids' efforts rather than praising them for being smart is far more effective to motivate students. Furthermore, the type of praise is important. It must be very specific, genuine, and intermittent. Scholars from Reed College and Stanford reviewed over 150 praise studies. They determined that praised students become much more risk-averse and lack perceived autonomy. There are consistent correlations between liberal use of praise and shorter task persistence. Students often quit when the rewards disappear. There were a few times I regretted my career change, times that I was unhappy as a teacher. Eventually, I developed and internalized several ironic and humorous metaphors to help me keep things in perspective. First, Gulliver, the giant strapped down by hundreds of little Lilliputians. Teachers can feel trapped, unable to act by the many demands made on them, worn out by the myriad of decisions constantly required without having time to figure out what's really best. Second, metaphor is Gumby, the children's toy who is infinitely malleable, constantly bending and adapting to the continuous pressures and demands put on you as a teacher. Third is the old story of the emperor's new clothes. Teachers sitting in endless trainings and staff meetings, being regaled with the latest great ideas for dramatically improving student performance. everyone afraid to question the wisdom of the latest fad for fear of standing out in the crowd. Better to quietly pretend and then just ignore stupid directives. Fourth metaphor, pearls before swine. Be careful about putting a lot of effort into committees and reform efforts. The top-down administrative structure has little or no interest in your ideas. Save your good ideas and work for the classroom, for your students. Education, of course, is only part of what teachers and schools are expected to do. There's a current narrative to the effect that schools can make up for centuries of slavery and poverty if only we raise standards appropriately. Expect and demand more from children. Teach them the self-made man myth that they can all rise to membership in the dream of prosperity if only they work hard enough. Jacques Barzun, professor of history at Columbia University, wrote in 1945 in his book, Teacher in America, quote, "Apparently, education is to do everything that the rest of the world leaves undone. Produce patriots, generate a classless society, root out racial intolerance, improve labor relations, provide affordable housing, improve marriages, etc., etc. There are educational shops for repairing every deficiency in man and nature. Education is the hope of the world only in the sense that there is something better than bribery, lies, and violence for righting the world's wrongs. If this better thing is education, then education is not merely schooling. It is a lifelong discipline of the individual, by himself, encouraged by a reasonable opportunity to lead a good life." Unquote. But what of the, quote, reasonable opportunity to lead a good life? Is it there? William Ryan wrote in 1971 in his book, Blaming the Victim, quote, "What man is able to make happen by his own will and his own action determines the quality of his life. What some are accustomed to thinking of as the enduring, debilitating characteristics of the poor, such as apathy, fatalism, depression, and pessimism, are actually the straightforward manifestations of the dynamics arising from lack of power." Or, as Diane Ravitch wrote in her book, The Life and Death of the Great American School System, commenting on No Child Left Behind, quote, "Education is a reflection of society. Education is integrally related to the society in which it is embedded. Schools can provide a route out of poverty for determined individuals, but schools by themselves, no matter how excellent, cannot cure the ills created by extreme social and economic inequality. They cannot create jobs, or repair broken families, or end neighborhood deterioration, or stop crime. The achievement gap begins long before the first day of school. In the end, what did I learn about my role as part of education? It all boiled down to being fully present while managing my health and emotions. I posted in my class what I called my, quote, recipe for success for the kids. It turned out to be the recipe for myself to follow as well. And when I did, every day in the classroom was a good day. I'll leave you with that recipe. First, show up. Every day. On time. Nothing else counts if you're not there. Second, cooperate with other students, teachers, parents. Together we can achieve more than we can alone. Third, care. Treat others as you want them to treat you. It's the golden rule, present in all religions and ethical systems. Fourth, work and play with purpose. Time is precious. Don't waste it. And fifth, enjoy yourself and those around you, appreciating the basic goodness of life and those around you. Thank you very much.